You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
So for today's episode, I'm here with Patrick Reynolds. We've got a really interesting episode today, focusing on a couple of interesting concepts. The first one being someone who really has thrived in enjoying and working with challenger brands. So that's going to be a recurrent theme for today. And also this idea of the concept of what it means to actually gain unfair market share, which Patrick's going to explain to us. So Patrick, great to have you on the show. Why don't you just start by giving a bit of a background on where you are today and how you got to where you are?
Sure. First of all, it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me. I am the chief marketing officer for a customer data platform called Blueconic. Blueconic takes and organizes all your customer data that you're collecting and makes it sort of actionable so that you can take the data that you collect and you can sort of reflect it back into the marketplace in the form of smarter, more intelligent, more personalized sort of engagement for the end customer. So that's what we do. And I've been doing that for a couple of years now. Before that, I spent some time at MasterCard leading marketing for their data and services organization globally. Before that, I was in the loyalty space, CMO of a public company for a hot minute there. And then I really started in kind of traditional marketing, but really actually traditional B2C advertising. And so there's a real study of contrast there between how things once were and how they are today and potentially sort of where they're going. And it's probably an interesting conversation.
So let's talk about this first idea that you said that you love challenges and challengers. Talk a bit more about that.
Well, there's no fun. When you're on top, there's only but one place to go. And so I like brands that are kind of not necessarily the biggest, not necessarily the best funded, not necessarily at the top, but they're smart, they're scrappy, they're aggressive, and they want to get to the top. And that, to me, the climb is where the fun is. It's, you know, the summit's great, but the climb is where all the action is. And so I kind of like doing that. And as a part of that, as you said in your intro, there's this idea of unfair share, which is to say, trying to punch above your weight and actually gobble up more market share than you have any right to. So if you're taking on the 800-pound gorilla, maybe you have rights to claim 2-4%, something like that, of share. We have an expression, play with zeros. Let's try to go from 2-4 to 20-40, and let's see what that looks like. And it's this idea of just out hustling, outsmarting, out clevering your larger, more funded, more superior on paper competition to see if you can get the better of them.
What kind of muscles do you need to develop in that world compared to when you are on top? And maybe talk about a few examples of, or example that really comes to mind where you've done that and how you did that.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that the twin disciplines that serve you best there are a willingness to take some risks. If you are the challenger, you are going to have to take some risks if you want to gain share. And the other thing is tremendous agility. You have to be ready for any misstep that the competitor might make or any opportunity that the market might make, whether it's the economy or anything else, that you can gain unfair share of if you're in a position that you can capitalize on it. So speed is critically important. And again, willing to take a few shots, even if maybe all the facts aren't in, you're going to kind of roll the dice and see what happens. But thoughtfully, that's a part of it as well.
So pick a story, whether from where you work today or from your past, where you've actually done that. Tell us that story and how you did it.
Well, I've worked with a number of different challenger brands. One of my favorite stories is when I was working on a brand. I don't know that they've left the United States, so apologies to international people who may be listening, but it is a satellite TV brand called Dish Network. Dish Network is founded by one of the all-time outlaws of not only business, but practically society, a guy named Charlie Ergen, who was one of the first guys and literally personally put satellites into space. I won't say by himself, but in a way that is so improbable. It was like Charlie Ergen here and NASA here. So that's a challenger. So getting to know Charlie a little bit and his sort of worldview, it became clear to me that very traditional marketing was probably not going to scratch any itch that Charlie had. So when I was at Publicis in Seattle, devised a campaign that actually did get him to kind of stop what he was doing and sit up straight, and eventually a big smile. We weren't sure if we were going to die or get canonized that day, but we came up with a campaign that said cable sucks, which had really never been done in that bold or daring way before. So again, it was a calculated risk, but it stemmed from an insight that for satellite to gain share, cable had to lose share. It is literally a zero-sum game. Everybody's got one of the two. So if you want to gain unfair share or just any share at all, you need to take it at the expense of the various cable companies in the United States. And so rather than talking about features and benefits of satellite that made it at least comparable, if not superior to cable, we decided to take the emotional route, which was to say, nobody loves cable. Everybody thinks they're getting hosed by it. So let's just call that. Let's get people on our side. And then from there, we can get into rational benefits. So it was a very emotional tact to what had been a more channels, greater clarity. That was kind of the noise of the market before. And we just came out and really had an audacious campaign, which, by the way, did get some blowback as well, but they did actually have some very good results when it ran.
Yeah, we know Charlie well being here in Denver. Is there also an aspect to this that when you play the challenger brand that you have to, you can't use the traditional playbook?
Yeah, you can't. And so again, in that campaign, we did everything. You know, we had out of home, we took every single Dish Network installation van that was on the street, and we put cable socks all over it. So it was really a guerrilla, G-U-I-R-L-L-A, campaign from the top to the bottom. And whereas cable kind of lived off owning their channel, which is cable, we looked at it from a variety of different ways and sort of came at them from all angles, much like you would a much larger, better funded, better equipped competitor. So it was pulled all the way through.
Now, it's interesting because you talk about the being the challenger, but then you also worked at a brand like MasterCard for quite a few years. And when we were talking before the recording, from a brand standpoint, you'd argue that MasterCard is one of those brands where they've invested a lot at that overarching brand level. Everyone knows about Priceless. There was a lot written about even last year that MasterCard were even going to drop the MasterCard from the visual identity because the overlapping circle symbols were now so iconic. But you at the time were actually working at one of the divisions as yes. well. So talk about how brand either helped or didn't help when you're working down in one of the BUs, because we associate a lot on the consumer side, but you were working actually on the B2B side.
Yeah. So you're sort of captive to your own success there, right? So I say MasterCard, you'll say Priceless, or you might even hear it now, the mnemonic. MasterCard's very into the signature, audio signatures as well. And it's an incredible, it's one of the world's greatest brands, most valuable brands, et cetera, et cetera. But 99.9% of humans on the earth think of MasterCard as a consumer sort of credit card brand. I think that perception is evolving, of course, but it's certainly first and foremost the Priceless company, as it should be. And if you look at their stock trajectory and everything else, that's a very, very good place to be. Now, if you, like me, are toiling to try to establish a B2B brand and say that you have a value proposition, not only for banks and lenders, but also for merchants and other kinds of companies, you have some explaining to do as to, well, how does Priceless play into this? Well, I mean, I can give you a marketing answer to that, but that's really the consumer part of the business. So here at Data and Services, we have a trove of data on global transactions that no one else can equal. And I can tell you about your business with a level of granularity and specificity and fact nobody else could possibly do. Let's talk about you and your customers and how you engage and what they're doing and when they're doing it and why they're doing it to the degree that we can know that, et cetera, et cetera. We have a whole raft of some of the world's leading consultants that can give you the kind of market intel you need to gain unfair share from your competitors in the B2B world, et cetera, et cetera. So it didn't hurt us, but there's always that, what's this got to do with Priceless component to it, which is only fair. And when you're starting something new or something that is sort of child to the parent, like all children, at some point you kind of want to come up from mom and dad's shadow. And that's a little bit of the exercise as well. I would also hasten to add that at some point, ideally, those children come back and are happy to be affiliated with it. But at first you're kind of like, no, I want to do it my way. I want to be my own thing. I want to be the challenger, not the incumbent. Because when we were at Data and Services, we weren't competing against Visa or American Express or anybody else. We were competing with the world's largest consultancies and the world's largest technology companies. And they had one thing that they did. They were focused on their area, and we were sort of spread a little bit differently.
So did Prices provide in any way umbrella support, or was it something that you had to actually put to the side because you had other challenges at the time coming in that you had to address and counter in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, you certainly never had to explain the company that you worked for when you talked to anybody on God's green earth. But again, there's this perception of, MasterCard, transactions. So for example, to a lot of merchants, transactions are equal expense. Right. So they think, aren't I giving you guys enough money already? You know, with, you know, transaction fees and such. And I think that's something that, you know, it's like, no, we have a whole other portfolio of things that we can add so much value to your business and do. It's just, it's a different conversation than a McKinsey would have to have. It's a different conversation than an Adobe or a Google would have to have, and so on and so forth. They're a little bit more monolithic, and we were trying to actually dimensionalize an established brand.
Right. The brand's talking about prices, but you've got your customers actually saying, no, what is the actual price?
Correct.
It's not what is the actual price.
Correct.
When you talk about the first part of your career, your first CMO gig, you said that if you had the data, your CMO gig would not have ended.
Correct. Yeah. So again, this is in the prehistoric times when data was very scarce and very loosely defined, I will say. And it would often take, at the time, we did have a data sort of consultancy that we'd work with to go through sales data and that, but they would sort of come to us in a small army of people, would pack a conference room, and they would talk about things that maybe happened 2 quarters ago. Like, we've looked at all your transaction data, and you know, here's some patterns that we see emerging. Well, that's all well and good, but what's going on right now? If you take a look at the speed with which the world is spinning today, as you and I are recording this, we could talk about the Middle East, we could talk about Eastern Europe, we could talk about the geopolitical situation, even within the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ain't nobody got time for 2 quarters ago. There's no insight that you're going to give me from 2 quarters ago that's going to help me today, the theory goes. And in the case of where I was, which was at a very high-end consumer electronics brand, I don't really think we smelled the danger until the wolf was at the door. I'm not saying I don't think we did not smell the danger until the wolf was at the door. The danger being people are starting to buy cheaper things, more disposable things. They're moving away from high-end audio in favor of portable. Right. They're saying quality, I'm willing to take lesser quality for greater access, i.e. iPods at that time and things. And by the time we worked out that that's what was going on, to say nothing of the proliferation of phones where people would talk more than they would listen in their car, as an example, it was came, set, and match. There was nowhere to go. That was it. We had all these physical locations that we were no longer needed. E-com was going to become the norm. Lower ticket, faster, more disposable products would be the norm and still are today. That industry all but cratered. I don't know that we could have really done too much about it other than maybe change form factor, maybe change mix of products, et cetera, et cetera. We may have forestalled the inevitable, but I don't know that we could have gotten out of that box, but we certainly would have been more prepared for the fight.
And Patrick, remind us what brand we're talking about here, because we know we're jumping about into different parts of your career.
Not at all. It was called Tweeter Home Entertainment. And I can't tell you the amount of interviews I got in the mid-2000s on the basis of people thinking I had been the CMO of Twitter for a length of time. That was extremely helpful on a certain level, but ultimately not helpful. But yeah, think of like a high-end Best Buy or something selling $5,000 to $10,000 TVs, $20,000 to $30,000 to $50,000 audio equipment and so on. All those things are gone now. You'd have to have your head screwed on backwards to spend that much on any of those things unless you're the rarest of the rare. There's just no market share for that.
Talk about the importance then of identifying strategically and then being able to track what would be a leading indicator, right? Something that gives you that sense of what's truly important. How do you identify what a good leading indicator is, and how do you use it?
Well, one way to do it is the exact opposite. Work backwards. Find the things that are working and then sort of deconstruct. How did we get to this place? So if you're a retailer, you might say like, well, what else was in the basket? Every time you see X, it's accompanying Y. That would be something. And then you take those customers that are your most profitable, your most frequency, whatever the case may be, and then you start to look for lookalikes within your own database at first and then outside of your four walls after. So working backwards is a good way to do it. But it's also anytime you see little anomalous blips of people are coming to a certain area more often, or people are doing things in a way that had not been done historically. Two components to that. You have to know in near real time that they're doing it. You have to have some historical benchmark as to how they used to do it. And all of that requires a sophisticated data operation.
I feel like when it comes to leading indicators or even just single KPIs that organizations use, I don't know about you, but my email inbox or text, I feel like I get at least 5 emails a week where someone asking me for an NPS score.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on NPS?
I think it's a good indicator. It's just an indicator, though. I think basically people vote with their wallets. So I can pretty well tell how things are doing by deal volume and flow and ticket size, depending on what industry you're in. You know, that's one thing. I do sound a little old school in that regard, but people do vote with their wallets in my experience. I think NPS is a really good, simple, elegant way for people to give feedback pretty lightweight, low touch, easily. There's also things like G2 reviews if you're in the software game. Well, here's the truism. This is the same where they're talking about retailer software. The people who love you are generally like, yeah, they're great. The people who hate you will go on and on and on and on and on. But so the thing about G2 or any kind of peer reviews is they skew negative, but they're our source of intel as well. So you do have to look at those.
You're talking about being at a high-end retailer that competed, the high-end version of Best Buy. I saw Best Buy last year at a conference talk about how they were thinking about NPS. And what I thought was really interesting was the importance actually of how you phrase the question becomes really important. And what they said is when they were just asking, would you recommend Best Buy, they were getting a lot of 4 or 5s. When they tweak that question to how do we deliver compared to your expectation, the benchmark actually came down. Because Then all of a sudden, a 3 is, yeah, you delivered on my expectation. I'm only going to reward you with a high, well, not necessarily a 5, because NPS is typically done on a 1 to 10 scale. But all of a sudden, when you frame that question, the scores came down because now you actually had to score higher to over deliver.
Yeah, 5 is what I expect.
Five is what I expect. And so all of a sudden, it actually starts to become a lot more useful for them, because otherwise they were getting all these 7s and 8s when they were just really meeting expectations just by changing the question.
I think another twist on that same thing that is not, you can't really do this in an NPS framework, but is along the lines that you described is, and this goes back to my days in advertising, this is the old strategy question, is what do you want the customer to think, feel, or do instead of what? So the way that you would translate to NPS is, how was your transaction today? It was a 8. Great. How do you think it would have compared to an Amazon transaction? Because that's who, right? That's who Best Buy is competing against. They're like, what? Okay, I could buy it on bestbuy.com, or I could go into a store and get the thing. Okay, that's great. I'm glad that the frontline service is good. I'm glad that the store was displays were nice, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, the price must have been reasonable. Was that a better, worse, or identical experience to Amazon? That's really the question that you need to tease out in that situation. NPS is not ideal for that.
I think that's such an interesting insight, because so oftentimes as brands, we just think about it in our own context, when in reality, consumer is viewing it. You're just one moment in an experience of their day. They've just ordered something on their app to pick up at a Starbucks. They've just ordered something that's going to be delivered in Amazon in 4 hours. So they're not thinking about your brand in the context of your world. They're thinking about it in the context of their life in general. It's such a good insight.
Yeah. And when I was in the streaming audio space, a conversation that we'd have quite a lot with typically radio people is people don't want just the songs. They want these humans around it and storytelling and all this other frivolity and everything like that. Well, the data just did not support that. people wanted the songs that they wanted. And if you want to listen to Radiohead and you want to listen to They're There, first of all, it's preferable to hear it when you want to hear it. So I go to Spotify and I listen to it. But that song sounds exactly the same, independent of compression and all the other technical things. On Apple, on Spotify, you name it, the radio, it's the same content. So the packaging has limited utility in most cases. So if I need a new flat panel TV, what's it cost? And how does it get into my house and on my wall? Those are the criteria. And I really don't care. It's the same TV, whether I get it from this one, or Amazon.
This conversation about data is a good segue to the almost like second half of the conversation, because almost the second half of your career, because if in the first half, the challenge was you didn't have enough data, you talk a lot about in the second half, this danger that we have around worshiping false idols in the context of the amount of data that we have together. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the first half, and I am decidedly aging myself here, a lot of business was predicated on relationships, right? You have to trust me, CMO of McDonald's, that this campaign that we're doing is working, because this is what we do for a living. We are the world's leading experts in the creation of advertising. And we'll talk to 8 people in 8 markets, and they will attest to the fact that, yes, that's wonderful, and I feel better, and blah, 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 blah. It was kind of silly and superficial then. It's sillier and more superficial now. But there really wasn't other good ways to sort of prove the efficacy of things. And basically, you were doing fine if the business was good. It's the old correlation causation. I don't know which it is, but if my sales are up, I'm assuming that the advertising or the marketing is working. Let's use marketing for this case. If my sales are up, great. It must be working. If my sales are down, it must be you. And you really didn't have a leg to stand on outside of relationships, right? So that was then. Today, what I see a lot of, and it's troubling, is sort of, again, you say false idols. People thinking like, has anybody seen my open rates? Or has anybody seen the number of downloads that we've achieved, or the conversion rate from this stage to this stage? And that may or may not be interesting to anyone, but I guarantee you can't take it to the bank. And that's the difference. When people were judging you, it was on the basis of how much was their deposit in their bank every day then. Now it's these sort of inside baseball, navel-gazy kinds of marketing things that we're getting very excited about. And we don't typically take the time to connect that to actual business outcomes. So pulling this full circle is like, let's see where the business is humming. And then let's look backwards at attribution to see, how did we get to this place? What did marketing actually contribute to that? Or was it the decay of a competitor? Was it just sheer demographics changing, or whatever the case may be, right? Now it's just, we think of, in some cases, marketing metrics as a terminus. Well, they're not, right? They are a means, not an end. But sometimes we get that twisted, in my view.
And then how do we deal with things that become harder to measure, like brand, because it's more intangible, right? From a performance marketing standpoint, attribution has its own challenges around what part of attribution do you measure. But how do you balance this thing, this aspect of, just because it's harder to measure, we know as marketers, it's important to focus on the brand and on the demand gen. How do you handle the brand part of it when it's harder to measure, it's harder to translate into metrics or outcomes that the CFO can actually look at and understand, as opposed to these terms like brand equity that don't really mean anything to a finance person?
Yeah, we have come a long, long way. Marketing is still a blend of art and science. It's much more science than it has ever been, but there is still an element of art to it. And I, for one, am elated that that is the case. Not everything can be explained. Marketing is kind of that ghost in the machine, the brand rather is that sort of ghost in the machine that sort of has that, I can't say why, but things just get a little bit better when it's good. Having said that, there are things that you can do. For example, you can look at sort of store or site traffic. If it goes up sort of organically, that's one thing. Inbound inquiries, media coverage, RFP submissions. There's a number of things that, again, can be correlated. You can't always say caused, but you can say correlated to the increased stature of a brand, partnership outreach. There's all kinds of things you can do. Supporting premium pricing, one of my favorites. So you can take a price move. And if your brand is strong enough, you generally have that elasticity. If your brand is not strong enough, you generally will see some shrink. And that's another good indicator of that.
Yeah, what I like about those examples is even if marketing doesn't necessarily own some of those metrics, they're all metrics that the business can understand. And somebody said to me the other day, said, I think you're better off trying to tie marketing into a metric that they may not necessarily own, but is accepted and recognized by the business, rather than trying to introduce a metric that is fully owned, but means less. So talk about your role as part of the ecosystem, even if you don't own it.
That is such a huge insight. If nobody took anything away from all this jabbering, that is what they should take away, which is to say it is a fool's errand to think that you are going to teach your executive colleagues about marketing and they'll ever give a shit. They never in 1,000 lifetimes will. Never. I don't know if I can say that. They never will care enough or at all, to be very honest with you. You have to adapt your language to theirs. They don't care about MQLs and they don't care about stage conversion and funnel velocity and all those things. That's like wah, 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 wah. So more customers came into the door. More people came to the website. Transaction counts got more frequent and basket size got larger. Churn reduced. Returns came down. Then you can, again, you can't claim all of these things, but you can say, let's just look at the trends of the data. And then when we did brand changes or when we ran a campaign, and again, you can say this is correlation, if not causation.
And in many ways, it goes back to the conversation about data as well, because this was a key thing I heard the other day as well, that we're so focused on data and we've forgotten the importance of storytelling around the data. And as much of it is internally.
1,000%. Yeah, we sort of struggle with the restaurant versus the grocery store thing where we're so grabbing all these different, you know, I'll take one of this and some of this and some of this and some of this. And, you know, we've stocked all the cupboards and everything, but nobody has the recipe to make anything with these things. So if you don't have this experience, the skill, the creativity, the agility to say like, oh, I just got a new ingredient in. I could make something really cool with that. And then in this case, that ingredient is data, a new data point. Like, oh, I did not know that. Let's spin up something on that. Let's do a social campaign on that. Let's do a customer testimonial about that. Let's make that a speaking submission, an award submission, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where, yes, it's one thing to have a lot of data. It's another thing to know what the data kind of means. That third leg of the stool is the hardest one, which is how do you convey that meaning to a wider audience inside and especially outside of marketing and outside of your organization?
How much emphasis do you place on that internally with your own team? So as a CMO who has a team and you've probably got a mix of generalists and specialists, what are some of those skills and aspects of how you level your teams up?
Yeah, we really strive imperfectly to strike that balance between why Blueconic and how this feature drives value for your business, Mr. Customer or Mrs. Customer, right? Like both of those things have to happen. If it's just Blueconic is wonderful, they've got the smartest people, they've got the best platform, and it has the highest performance ratings, that's cool. I have jobs to do though as a marketer, right? So how can I find more lookalikes more efficiently at lower cost? That's right. I need both of those things. Oh, Blueconic, I've heard of them. Tell me about lookalike modeling. If it's just lookalike modeling, it's like, whatever. You know what I mean? It's just never going to stick. You need to hold both of those things in the same orbit.
Talk a bit about then lookalike modeling and how do you do lookalike modeling well, because I think that really has its foundation in segmentation and understanding customers.
It has. So again, going back to the prehistoric times, the whole notion of direct marketing at the time was the kind of, for lack of a better term, birds of a feather, right? If you lived in this zip code, and if you did, you probably had this kind of disposable income. You probably had a family that was about this size. You probably had this sort of political leaning. You probably, right? And that was the best that we had to work with at that time. And at a super high 10,000 foot level, that's kind of true, right? My town, there is a sort of persona to it, if you will. But if you go lower and lower and lower and lower to the ground, you see that we're quite different here. On this side of my house, coincidentally, I have a very young doctor. On this side of my house, I have an older gentleman doctor. They have the exact same last name. One is an Australian immigrant. The other is an Irish immigrant. And I am here in the middle, a pug-nosed American marketer. So we're not all the same on this block. We're not all the same in this town. The only way you can tease the three of us apart is in the data, right? It's in the data. It's in the details. It's in the specifics. So again, if you're doing lookalike modeling, I look at who are our best customers as little individually. What characteristics do they have? And then I can go out into the marketplace and try to find people that mirror them as closely as possible, not on some sort of theoretical framework.
And then how can you get to the attitudinal aspect of those lookalikes around the notion of you want people who have a shared belief?
That is still relatively tricky, sort of the emotional component. What I'm speaking of now is largely sort of behavioral, people that behave a certain way. Let's look for people that behave a certain way. What's behind the behavior is not something that sort of our software and our technology sort of solves for. I do think that's critically important, but it's not, we watch people's feet and their wallet, and then other people kind of look at the other.
So it's the actions. But so talk a bit about that. What are the sort of actions that now you can observe and build lookalike data sets from that you couldn't in the past? Because again, we're not just talking about demographics. Like you said, we're able to go a lot deeper into actual behaviors.
Yeah, demographics are a very, very small part, I think, of what most people are looking at. It's much more behavioral. So maybe we'll have a customer that says, a good customer will go to a website 3 times and spend X amount of minutes. Within 72 hours, they will look at the same items on their app. If they are a mixed retailer in terms of physical and e-com, they might say, then they'll go to a store and actually touch, feel, look, make sure that it's good. And then they'll generally buy on their app and get it delivered because that's more effective than having to lug it home from a showroom, as an example, right? So that's what we see. It's X amount of research visits. Within 72 hours, they do an app, visualize this in your home, take a picture of your room, take a picture of the furniture. Within a week, they visit a showroom if there's one available to them. And then within 48 hours, they're putting something in their cart. Each of those, if you assume that that is the sort of the customer experience that you're looking for, there are things as a marketer you can do to make sure that's happening. If they go to the site, you can ping them in 24, 48 hours to also check it out. Look at this in your room with the app. If they do that, you can then say, did you know that within 12 miles, there's a showroom and that particular product is there and you can go see it, sit on it, touch it, feel it, et cetera. After they do that, presuming they identify themselves, which there's different little tricks to do that as well, then you can sort of ask for the order. If they don't make it immediately, you can perhaps provide an offer, et cetera, et cetera. So if you know that, then you can kind of take that model out into the marketplace.
Talking about this idea of understanding customers and behaviors, one thing I think you said was really interesting is the importance of being a keen observer of people and life and the sense of what active listening means. Can you talk a bit about that and how foundationally important that is?
Yeah, this goes back to a guy that I learned from a guy named Dr. Bob Deutsch is his name. And he had this thing about observing people in life. And he was a sort of an anthropologist. But the way he would do it is sort of an anthropologist of current day humans in your area, right? And this, by the way, goes back to things that we used to do before we had all this data. So the data is great, but your senses are also great. So what Dr. Bob would espouse would be things like, make sure you take the subway whenever you can. Look at what people are reading. Look at how they're dressed. How many are congregating together? What do they look like? Where do they get off? How do they get there? If you're a retailer, walk around the store. What do they touch versus what do they look at? When do they stop? Do they look at the price? Do they look at the label? Do they hold it up to themselves? And it really is a very important thing that you can do both physically with your 5 senses or however many you have, and you can do it digitally. You could also look at behavior, but if you put those 2 things together, you really get not just the what, but in some cases you get the why. Why do they do that? Why do they put certain toys in a toy store at this level of the store? Because that's eye level for a little kid. How do you get a kid to give shin kick to mom or dad that they want the thing? You put it where they can see it, touch it, play with it, and then they don't buy things, or they probably do buy things more now than they used to, but generally they need mom or dad to make a purchase. So you have to market to them to get their interest, and then you market to mom and dad to make the purchase. So it's very hard to be a great marketer in the ivory tower. And I think that situation has been exacerbated with COVID and all the other things, where people are working more in their house, as I am now. It looks like you are as well. So I think it's super valuable to make sure you are out there amongst them and hearing and seeing and getting a vibe for what's going on in the marketplace. It makes you much better at what you do.
And how would some of the ways that you can do that, for example, maybe if you work in B2B?
Yeah. So we spend a lot of time on what are our customers reading? What events do they go to? Who do they think of as thought leaders? All of those things we ask. And then we avail ourselves of all those same things, even if they don't directly relate to what we're trying to do, just so we can get into the headspace of, oh, I get the agenda that's not directly related to the job they hired us to do, but this is the sort of the agenda behind that. Oh, now that makes more sense. Oh, the cyclical nature, the seasonality of their business. It's not really directly germane to how we talk to them, but it's critically important in their sort of non-frontal lobe, right in the back of their head, that's always on. And so the more we can understand that situation, the better we are at our jobs.
Yeah. And some of that, to your point, is even observable. If you're not asking those questions, which I think a lot of people don't, you can go into, for example, if you find 100 of your customers or even of lookalikes that you're targeting, go to their LinkedIn profile and you can see what people are posting, what they write about themselves, or you can aggregate and collect all of that. It's impossible not to come out of it with insights.
1,000%. And what you find out is that people have great dimension, even if you're talking to them about very specific technical software. There's a lot. We all have these really robust lives. And the more actually you do sort of account-based marketing, where you sort of narrow the aperture a little bit, so you're not looking at every potential customer on the earth, you're looking at a few key ones, to your point, through just non-stalkerist observation, you can go, I think I know a little bit more about what makes her tick. I think I see what's important to her. It's about DEI, it's values. It's about currency of technology. It's about, right? It's like, these are that she's giving the breadcrumbs. Let's just follow them and sort of play it back, the messaging.
So with all of the experience that you've had, Patrick, I mean, look at where you are today. You look at the teams that you manage. What are some of those core leadership principles that you bring in day to day?
Well, I haven't really changed the leadership principles since the beginning of time, which is, I think, fair, firm, and friendly is the sort of methodology that I like to do. And it hasn't changed, and I haven't felt the need to change it. And I don't think the people who work for me do. If you're just generally equitable, which is not to say treat people identically, but fair. If a decision is made and now we go, people know that they'll spend a lot less time dragging their feet. And friendly, I spend a lot more time with my coworkers than I do my wife and children. And that's twisted and sad, but it's the world that we live in. And so you just have to bring a little bit of joy, a little spark of life to it, or else you'll burn out, or they'll burn out on you one way or the other. So you just have to bring those. But I think people, the people who are hungry, the people who are agile, most of the greats I've ever worked with have huge amounts of imposter syndrome, and they're just never satisfied with where they are. They always think they have something to prove. That's really time immemorial. That hasn't changed even a little bit.
Is that something that you look for when you're hiring talent? And if so, how do you ascertain that in an interview process? And we're all familiar with like the artificiality of what that process can be like.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I try to gauge people's competitive level. And I'm not talking about sports competitive, like I was the captain of the whatever rugby team. They have high standards. They take it personally. They are very concerned with doing a good work product. It means something to them. I sort of make it my job to sort of dig into that a little bit, because there's a lot of people who have the skills, but generally it's the will that separates. And will kind of comes first for me. Skills we can teach. Will is harder.
Any good tips like the kind of questions that you ask, or aspects of how you structure an interview to get to that aspect?
No, I don't. I will just give you one tip. Actually, something I learned, I can hear the collective eye roll of your audience, but it was in one of these improv things that, you know, corporate improv things. And what dawned on me there is the key to being successful at improvisation is having no thoughts in your head whatsoever, a completely empty head. So I'm not thinking, I want to say this, I want to ask this, I want to do this, I want to do this. I actually have nothing at all going on. Easy for me. And then you say something. Now that's all I have to work with. Now let me go into that. You said you were really interested in customer experience. Well, what kind of customers? What kind of experiences? Oh, well, these kind of customers. Well, have you ever done it? Right? It just one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. So I don't really, I just try to get you to say something. And then I take that and I try to take it a little bit further. And then you respond. I try to take it a little bit further, a little bit further. So I'm not a, I have a script. Hopefully our people are not listening to this because we do have a sort of list of things we're probing on, but I'm not particularly good at that. It feels very wooden to me. I need to listen to what you say, ask a question, ask a follow-up, follow-up, follow-up.
Yeah, well, you totally took the empty, the nothing going on in your head joke from me, because that is exactly what I was going to do. But I think what I really took away from your point is this notion of starting with no thought connects to the notion of allows you to then really do active listening.
Yes.
And ask that next question, ask the why or the what that gets you to the insight. Because if you start with predisposed ideas, you might miss what someone might say because you're thinking about your next question that you're going to ask.
Yeah. And that generally doesn't give you anything. If I say, what do you like to do for fun? You say you like to watch Liverpool Football Club. I say, how good are you at math? That doesn't follow. That's just me obviously going through a series of questions that doesn't really follow. Right. So it's like, oh, you like Liverpool? Oh, I like Liverpool. Why did you know? And that's how people get to open up and you start to reveal your true character, I think.
Well, as a Manchester United fan, I would.
Tough day for you yesterday.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that. Patrick, that is a great point to end because we don't want to talk about Man United anymore this season. This has been a really thoroughly insightful conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for being on.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face, and there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.